Shane will give you a short update on our ESG agenda, while Alexis will give you some context on how we're responding to the Royal Commission. We'll then have plenty of time for questions, so we've actually set this out so that there will be plenty of questions. I think that was key feedback from last year, so hopefully we'll get that right. On that note, I'll hand over to Shane.
Thank you and good morning. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are meeting and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Now, this is not a session where we're only going to tell you about the good things we're doing. I wanted it to be an annual checkpoint where we share with you what we've done, of course, what we are going to do next, where the areas that we think we are doing well, but also the areas where we think we can improve. So we won't be glossing over our mistakes. It is about transparency. I'll get onto the right slide. It is about transparency and, of course, accountability. At the moment, there's a global conversation about the future of capitalism, the prioritisation of various stakeholders, and the role of business in society. At ANZ, we believe that delivering great customer outcomes aligned with our purpose and underpinned by our values will drive balanced and equitable returns for all stakeholders. It's not about trade-offs, it's about aligned interest. By doing the right thing for customers and the community, we will be a better and safer organisation, providing more sustainable return for our shareholders. Now, we're not claiming victory, in fact, we're far from it, but this is the thinking that is shaping our future. And our foundation stone is our purpose, to shape a world where people and communities thrive. We've been talking to you about our purpose for a couple of years now. And of course, the challenge with purpose as a concept is that it does have the potential to evolve into nothing more than a catchy slogan. But that's not our approach. It wasn't imposed by me on the organisation, and it wasn't developed by consultants. It was a grassroots initiative of dedicated and engaged ANZ mid-level managers who recognised that we had strategies and ambitions, goals and targets, but we lacked a unifying vision for why 40,000 people come to work every day. So eight small words, but they capture a huge ambition. And one of those words in particular, and that is the word shape. It may sound arrogant to say that we want to shape the world, but ANZ operates in every nook and cranny of Australia and New Zealand. And so what we do and how we behave is shaping the future, whether we do so consciously or not. And it's our responsibility to be thoughtful and proactive, making a difference as a result of our decisions. Our continual challenge here at ANZ is to embed our purpose in everything that we do. We will not be successful, however, if when faced with tough choices, we shelve it in the interests of pure commercial gain. It also helps us focus on the things we care about most. There are obviously many causes that require attention, but there are some that are more relevant for a bank like ANZ. And we've chosen three: financial well-being, environmental sustainability, and housing. Now you might ask, and we've asked ourselves, why have we chosen three? Wouldn't it be nicer just to have one? To some level it would, but we recognise we're a very diverse organisation and we have a lot of activity. We're in 32 countries around the world, not just here in Australia and New Zealand. We've got an institutional bank, a corporate and commercial bank, a retail bank. And so we need to find things that really bind us together that have meaning for all of us. In terms of financial well-being, I'm not a huge fan of the term in terms of as something that we care about. What it's really about, in my own words, is if you want to have a community that's thriving, communities thrive because of participation. People have to participate in the community. That's the definition. What we mean by financial well-being is really equipping people with the ability to participate, whether that's through financial literacy or making sure that our products are blind to where our people come from, what their backgrounds are, what their wealth levels are, etc. So that's really, it's about financial inclusion as much as it is well-being. Sustainability is really, again, less about our footprint. We don't have a particularly large environmental footprint, but clearly our customers do. And it's about the work that we can do with them to nudge them and influence their decisions. But the one that's probably the most relevant for us is, of course, housing. Housing's core to our business. It's our largest business. and we have the financial wherewithal to actually make a difference in these areas. Whether that's by helping people enter the market for the first time through a rent-to-buy development we've funded, or upgrade as their situation changes. It's also part of the reason I was out last night at the CEO sleepout, because part of our housing interest, of course, starts with dealing with the people who are handling difficult situations of homelessness. While my sleeping outside for one night isn't going to solve very much, ANZ participants did, however, raise enough money to fund two new soup vans for Vinnie, so I'm hoping we have made a small difference. But the real difference we can make is ensuring that our products and services help people responsibly achieve their ambitions to buy, own or rent accommodation that is safe, sustainable and appropriate for their circumstances. At our recent half-year results, I outlined our key priorities for the business in the next few years. While we've transformed ANZ more in the last 3 years than in any time in our history, the market has been changing even faster. The headwinds that we saw in 2016 have actually been stronger than we predicted. I made the comment in May that we're not sitting idle hoping for a return to the golden years of banking, and I outlined these five priorities, which we've simplified a little bit more for today. It's not a change in strategy, but it's really more work constructing a simpler, more responsible and more adaptable bank. Firstly, owning up to and fixing the failures of the past. We will make substantive progress on remediation, with the vast bulk of our refunds to customers made and the processes re-engineered to avoid repeats. We'll be a stronger and safer bank for customers, and these costs will largely be behind us. Since we started on the journey, we've already remediated 550,000 accounts, increasing the number of remediation specialists from 130 to 200 in the last year alone and just in the bank. Now that's progress, but I acknowledge we've been too slow. Too slow to start and too slow to ramp it up. It wasn't a lack of intent, but rather a lack of truly understanding what was required. But I'm confident that we are picking up the pace. Our second priority is to focus on those areas where we really can make a difference for customers and to do those things better than anyone else. Third, like any household or any business, we need to do more with what we have. We have a lot of things we want to do for our customers, a lot of work to make ourselves safe and stronger, and that all requires investment. We can only fund that investment if we improve focus and productivity. We've done a good job in the last 3 years, but we've clearly got a lot more to do. All else being equal, in 2022, we expect to run the bank for about 10% less than it costs us to run the bank today, and with a global workforce and network to match. Our fourth priority, customers in the community expect a different relationship with their bank, and we need to get our people ready for a radically different future. And this includes increased investment in training and leadership, changing the fundamental reward structure for our people, and strengthening our accountability and consequence frameworks. And finally, we have a role to play providing the right tools, advice, and coaching for customers so they can enhance their financial well-being. And that final one has led us to reconsider how we measure success from a customer perspective. So we've developed 9 core principles that underpin customer financial well-being and that we are building into our products and services that will define the future ANZ. Now, this work's not complete, but it gives you an idea of the direction in which we're heading. We want to help our customers improve their financial well-being. These are not rocket science principles, but they are founded on solid research that shows that not enough of our customers, whether they're individuals or businesses for that matter, understand how important these principles are. So we have a role to play increasing awareness, coaching good behaviours, and ensuring that our products and services naturally drive these outcomes. Essentially, if we're helping our customers put money aside, borrow responsibly, pay down their debt faster, make sensible investments and protect the things that they can't afford to lose, they will be better off, and so will we. As I mentioned earlier, a core part of achieving our purpose is setting public targets and reporting against progress. These are some of the areas that we're doing well. such as funding. Sorry, there are some areas in which we're doing well, such as funding and facilitating $15 billion in low carbon solutions. There are other areas that need improvement. And you can see quite clearly here that we have more work to do in creating the best experience for our customers. Those fundamental principles I just outlined are critical to improving that. There are also new targets that are aligned to our purpose. Funding the creation of 3,200 new affordable, secure and sustainable homes in Australia is just one example. And while we're on track with recent investments, we will continue to look at how we can stretch ourselves in this space. At last year's briefing, we did a deep dive on sustainability, and this year I wanted to give you more detail on our approach to governance. I was saying to one of you before, in my 3 years as CEO and getting a lot more involved in the ESG experience, I've learnt a lot of the interest is really about the G. So as an industry and at our bank, we've seen what can happen when there are governance failures. As part of our efforts to continually improve, we've introduced a governance framework to provide a better structure for effective and responsible decision making within the bank. So when I became CEO, we took two important steps on ESG. First, I worked with our chairman, David Gonski, on the content of the new Ethics and ESG Committee, adding ethics to it and redesigning the charter as a result. And second, within the executive, we repurposed an existing reputational risk committee and broadened its charter to become the Ethics and Responsible Business Committee. These two committees are now critical elements of our governance structure, with regular meetings, senior membership, and the authority to make decisions, and they have complementary agendas. The board committee focused on establishing ethical and ESG guidelines and principles, and the executive committee operationalises these and makes decisions on such issues and policies. With respect to the board committee, our analysis shows over time it is focused primarily on how we go to market and how we govern issues. There are some topics here that you might expect to see, but instead are considered by the full board or other committees. So work we're doing on the Royal Commission, that is actually governed under the full board. For example, also customer remediation is looked at by the full board, and remuneration policies and practices covered by the HR committee. But this EESG committee meets quarterly, and each meeting opens with an overview of ESG operating environment covering a wide range of topics. These include regulatory and parliamentary inquiries, community sentiment, competitor activity, international developments on climate change, human rights, as well as our own stakeholder engagement activities. The two committees, while complementing each other, do differ quite considerably. The executive committee considers more operational, customer-related, who we bank topics, and a subgroup considers individual sensitive transactions, for example, if we're looking at deals in the resources sector. This executive committee is senior representation right across the group. It's chaired by me, and seven of its members are my direct reports. We also asked Dr. Simon Longstaff to join the committee to provide an outside perspective to the complex decisions we make as a bank. Working with the Ethics Centre and with key ANZ business and risk leaders, we've brought together our purpose and values with a set of new principles, in other words, to grapple with the question of what is right. Together, these form ANZ's ethical decision-making framework. It's operational and is now being used by this committee in its deliberations, as well as business and risk leaders across the bank. And these committees are having a real impact on who we bank and how we conduct ourselves. As you all know, this is an evolving area, and we're constantly scanning the environment to understand areas where we need to do more. Some of the areas we have on future agendas includes emerging social issues like data privacy, how we can better help vulnerable customers, understanding systemic themes from our complaints data, and potential ways that we can measure, track, and help improve our customers' financial well-being. Now, there are a series of case studies in your slide packs that provide detailed examples of the committees in action. Now, I'm not going to go through each of these in detail, but I did want to briefly touch on three. The first one, I don't need my glasses. The first one really comes under the category of who we bank, and raised by the fact that given our operations across 32 countries, many of which are in developing nations, and the complexity that brings, we did a deep dive into one nation in particular to understand whether our enhanced due diligence was sufficient in terms of understanding exactly not just who our customers are and what they do, but their ultimate ownership and structure, to make sure that we were comfortable, not just from a legal perspective, but from an ethical perspective, that we were dealing with the right aspects of that community. Now, one may ask question whether we should be in some of these countries at all, and we have discussed that, but we believe that given the nature of what we do, we can be a force for good, but only if we hold ourselves to a very high standard and apply these. So that's one example of this, and resulted in reasonably significant detailed review of how we were operating in this country and others, and changes to our policies as a result. The second one was to do with gaming. We know that gambling is a problem for some of our customers and many in the community. We also know that it's both regulated and legal, as well as enjoyed by many. And we want to make our products fair and responsible, so we introduced a restriction on the use of credit cards for gambling transactions beyond 85% of your account credit limit. We didn't believe it was right for customers to be able to use our services to put themselves in harm's way. This resulted in us declining over $17 million in real-time authorization transactions by customers who had already exceeded 85% of their limit. In reality, we know this small change will protect some customers from harm, but we're not naive, and we know that for some it has just moved their business elsewhere. But we still believe it was the right thing to do, even though it came at a cost to our business. And a further example, a final example, is the materiality review with external stakeholders to inform our response to the Royal Commission. As part of this, we've interviewed external stakeholders, many of whom may be in this room, ranging from investors through to consumer advocates. And the findings of these reviews were challenging. There was surprise at the extent of illegal and unethical behaviour across the sector, which will ultimately erode shareholder value. These findings were shared with the board recently, the Ethical and Responsible Business Committee, and the Royal Commission Oversight Group, informing our work to continually improve customer outcomes. So with that, I'll now pass to Alexis to provide an update on how we're responding to the Royal Commission before returning for Q&A. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Shane. As you can imagine, I think it would be remiss of us if we didn't talk about the Royal Commission in a forum like this. And I really want to share with you how we are thinking about it, what we have done to date, but I think more importantly, how we're going to approach this into the future. You know, it's interesting when you reflect on the Royal Commission, once the process of the Royal Commission had actually been completed and the 76 recommendations were delivered to us. I suppose when you go home on that first evening, it's very easy to look at those 76 recommendations and think, if I just tick through these, we will have complied with what the requirements of the Royal Commission were. And it quickly became evident to me over that weekend that if we did that, we would just end up in another risk and compliance exercise rather than a true change of our organisation and really alignment with the strategy that we're trying to adopt as we move forward. So after, you know, really thinking it as an organisation about how we needed to react, we felt that we needed to at least deliver in the short term some commitments to demonstrate that we were serious about this and we were serious about the changes that we believe we need to make to rebuild the trust of the community, our people and, of course, our customers. And so pretty much a few weeks after the recommendations were delivered, we made 16 public commitments, short-term commitments, that we believe we can deliver in this calendar year. And that was to demonstrate that we are serious about this, we're taking it seriously, and we will continue to take it seriously. And Shane's already mentioned a couple of those, but probably two notable ones from the 16 commitments was firstly our customer dispute resolution principles, or model litigant, which seems to have been the word of the street, whereby we made a public commitment to our customers that when we end up in dispute, which will inevitably occur at times, we're committed to operating a transparent and fair way. But I think just as importantly, we have got our legal partners to commit to the same principles. You know, so we will end up sometimes in a litigation process, but we've all agreed that in those processes we'll act fairly, transparently, and not use the power that we have. And on the remediation side, as Shane mentioned, we all acknowledge we have not moved fast enough in remediating the customers where there have been problems. And that's not with bad intent. You know, sometimes these issues are complex, but I think we'd agree at an executive level that we didn't really place enough single-minded focus on making sure those remediations happened. And yes, we have over 200 plus in our bank side of the organisation now dedicated to remediation, and about the same again in our wealth side. And on top of that, we have a number of people in the business who are assisting those people in an effort to really drive that remediation much faster. And as Shane said, we've remediated in the bank side over half a million customers to date. But what's pleasing for me is at the half year, that number, and that our half year in March, was about 420,000, and we've delivered another 130,000 in that 2 months. So we are getting better, we are getting faster. I don't think we're where any of us would like to be yet, but you can see that there is a process occurring there that's really going to help us to achieve that goal. And I think we're starting to use the resources we have available much better. So definitely a focus for us. So that was the 16 commitments, and I think you have the other commitments and we're up to in your pack. But when you think about that, that was really what we can do in the short term. And so after that, we really had to stand back and say, okay, great, we've got 16 commitments out there, but let's be really honest with ourselves about how we got to the position of seeing some of those issues that were in the Royal Commission raised. And as an organisation, we came up with 8 reasons. And we came up with these 8 reasons after really looking at all our witness statements that we'd actually supplied to the Royal Commission. And there were many of those that weren't in the public arena but were supplied separately. And being truly honest about what the findings were from those witness statements. And on top of that, really talking with our staff, talking with our risk committees, and talking with our board to get to an honest appraisal of the core of what the reasons, the issues in the Royal Commission were. And when you come up with those 8 reasons like that, it is very easy for an organisation like ours, and we quickly went down that road, to start developing action plans against each of those. Yeah, before we knew it, I think we had, I don't know, 52 odd different actions that we wanted to take, review our product governance, review our ongoing product review process, etc., etc. Things I'm sure you can imagine. And if we continued down the road, I think, yes, that's great. We need to have those action plans. But is that going to achieve what we want? Are we going to actually move the organisation culturally, move the organisation in terms of the focus on the customer? So we really stood back and said, yes, we have to have those action plans, but that's not going to be enough because it'll become a risk and compliance process. And I think it absolutely has to be aligned with the strategy of the organisation, the purpose of the organisation that Shane outlined, if we're to have success. So what we really decided is let's stand back, decide what the focuses really need to be to drive better customer outcomes, put measurements against those, and start to track those both at the executive committee and at the board. And as I'm sure you're aware in the room, at the same time we were going through the APRA self-assessment process, whereby we had to start to think about, the process that had gone on with one of our competitors and how did we see our own shop. And you quickly realise these things need to be brought together. The Royal Commission, APRA self-assessment, pretty much the same kind of themes were coming out. And that's how you saw the Oversight Committee that Shane mentioned before. And as a result of that, we decided that there needed to be five areas that we want to put measurements against, that we talk about at the board, that we talk about at our executive level, that will help us understand if we really are driving the change in the organisation that we want to become, at the end, more customer-focused. And some of these things we'd actually started well before the Royal Commission, and we all continue on that journey. You know, for instance, in simplification, a couple of years ago, we decided that we were not the best providers, when I say providers, producers, of some of the wealth solutions. And a couple of weeks ago, we actually completed the sale of our life insurance to Zurich. So that allows us to do what we're good at, interact with the customers, and allows a global life insurance player to help supply the solutions we need. So really allowing us to focus. I think importantly on the culture side, we decided, what do we want to look like? What is our aspirational culture? And came up with three themes about continuous learning, simplicity, you'll hear that word again and again, simplicity, making our processes simpler, our products simpler, our fee structures simpler, and customer outcomes. So we've put that aspirational culture out there, and we're really now working on the behaviours and what we can do to change behaviours to get towards that aspirational culture. Because I don't think any of us are naive enough to think culture changes in 1, 2, or 3 years, but we can start to change some of those behaviours. And one of the things we've been focusing on is our speak-up culture. You know, making sure our people feel safe to say when they don't feel we're doing the right thing or when we are doing the right thing. And I'm pleased to say in our recent survey, those results are really improving. So that's one area we're particularly focused on. And also, we've put in place culture audits. So on a regular basis now, we have a team of specialist people in our internal audit area that come in and do cultural audits of areas of our organisation and give themes and areas we can focus on. Because we all know in an organisation like ours, 40,000 people, there's going to be lots of mini cultures out there. So how do we harness the best and deliver on some of the others? And of course, remediation's there and always needs to be there. As Shane said, our board is very interested in that, rightly so at the moment, and we report to them on a regular basis. And one of the other ones there that you'll see is accountability and governance. We've talked a lot about governance today, but I think we'd all recognise that in an organisation like ours, we probably haven't been transparent enough about accountabilities, what actions we've actually taken. We'll tell you that we've taken actions and you have to kind of trust us. So we've really decided that we want to be much more transparent about the consequences that we take when something goes wrong, and there will be things that go wrong. So we have established a consequence review forum that on a quarterly basis meets to discuss anything that may have happened of a serious nature in our organisation and what the outcomes of that should be. And have decided as an organisation that we want to publish that as part of our annual review. So I'm not suggesting it'll look exactly like that because we're still working through this, but we have a commitment to be transparent about our consequences for executives and for senior management, and we'll start disclosing that later in the year. So there is a lot of work happening around the Royal Commission, around the APRA self-assessment, but if I can leave you with one message, it is that, in my view, and I think of the ANZ view, we have to align this to our strategy, because otherwise it just will become a ticker box exercise, and I don't think any of us want to go through this again. So that's where we're at. Thanks, Shane.
So just before we finish up, so we've talked about some of the areas that perhaps we would say we've struggled with a little bit or we still need to work on. One of them is resolving these long-standing complex customer issues. And when we talked about remediation, a lot of the remediation we're talking about in the big numbers, not to be dismissive of any of it, but the 2.6, 2.7 million customer accounts we were remediating, the average remediation we're talking there is $85, reasonably small. But embedded in there are some really long-standing, difficult ones, and we've really leaned into that. That is still a struggle. I think we're making progress. Many of you know the work we've done with our customer fairness advisor, Colin Neave, who's helped out personally getting involved in a lot of those. And we are making progress on closing a lot of those out. Some of them relate to the landmark issues that were pretty front and center in the Royal Commission, but we've still got a lot of work to do on that. And I think it's probably fair to say the longer those issues go on, the more difficult they become to resolve, actually. The second one is really this issue. We talked about the consequence review group. So that's a group that I chair. We look at making sure that we are acting appropriately, holding people to account, whether that's in terms of censure, financial consequence, or ultimately termination. Make those decisions to make sure there's equity across the organisation. But actually, one of the difficulties here is how do we get the balance right between holding people to account for bad behaviours, but actually also wanting to motivate the organisation to do good things. We don't want it always to be about negative reinforcement. And so I'm not suggesting we have the answer for that, but that's something that we're really focusing on. And then the last one is emerging, and I think partly because of the economic environment we're in, quite understandably we're being held to account and being asked to really think deeply about our responsible lending obligations in particular. That's a grey area in terms of definition. As a result of that, partly as a result of the greyness, partly as a result of the consequences, potential consequences of getting it wrong, I think banks like ourselves have really stepped away from parts of the community in the initial stages of thinking it's just potentially too risky. And that means we start to conflict with our other role, which is to actually be a responsible provider of credit to the economy. And so that, again, is a pendulum that has swung. And again, without making judgment where the pendulum is sitting today, it's just something we're really conscious of. And I think it's fair to say, again, without not complaining about it, we today, at my level, if we talk about serious complaints, more and more we're getting complaints of people who are not getting access to credit as opposed to anything else. And so that's something that we are considering about going forward. So with that, I'll let that go in terms of slides, and happy to answer questions. Obviously, Lex can help me out.